Welcome to Lead a Horse to Water, the Equine Training and Behaviour Podcast. I'm your host, Trudy Dempsey. As I record this, I am mid my Understand Clicker Training for Horses course. It's a fabulous course and there's some wonderful people on it and we're seeing some great training. Very different partnerships, which means the learning is incredible. I always love this course. It just teaches me so much as well. Coming up soon, I have a webinar for Understand Horses. You can find that at understandhorses.com, and that is Total Recall. No surprise, it's about how to teach a horse a recall, not only about how to teach them recall, but how to build a behaviour more or less from scratch. So this is really interesting, maybe for those of you who haven't started building behaviours yet, to have a think about what I would term as my behaviour blueprint and how we work on getting behaviours into our toolkit. So that one is on the 2nd of April, bargain price of £15, and plenty of time for questions and answers on that one. Coming up in May, I have my IABC conference presentation coming up. That's in Asheville, North Carolina. Really looking forward to visiting the States again and meeting lots of colleagues again. It's just a fabulous place to be. And there's a live event, if you're in the US, there's a live event in North Carolina, which is horse based, so we'll have horses to work with. The wonderful Shauna Karash and Dr. Robin Foster, amongst others, Gabriel Lencioni, we're going to be there, so can't wait for that. And when I come back from that, I start my IABC pain and discomfort ethogram course. That starts, I think, the 8th of May, and Understand Horses Live is in July. There's so much going on this year. Hope you enjoy today's podcast. I am talking to Polly. Polly Smith has an extensive background in the world of horses, a passion that has woven throughout her life since childhood. She was born into a family with a history of racehorses, and Polly's earliest memories include a vivid encounter with a tall, dark, brown horse at the age of 2. Her journey as a pony mad youngster began at the age of 9, marked by a memorable fall, as so often with many of us, from a skewball pony named Star Trek, who had been rescued with severe laminitis. Undeterred by challenges, Polly persevered through early riding school experiences, determined to regain her confidence, and with time spent at Anne Corey's yard, where she was exposed to her gentle lunging methods and innovative ideas about fitness regimes, Polly flourished. And after, she followed the working pupil route at Alden Craig Equestrian Centre, ultimately receiving a bursary from the Leonardo da Vinci Foundation that took her to Denmark for training, an experience that influenced her deeply despite witnessing some unsettling practices. Upon returning, Polly, now a mother, started forming her own opinions on horse care. Throughout her career, she has gravitated towards rehabilitating horses in need, focusing on understanding and connecting with them. Today, she primarily works in hoof care, specialising in helping horses express themselves and be heard, embodying a philosophy of awareness, lightness, and softness in her approach. I hope you enjoy this as much as we enjoyed recording it. Hi, Polly. It's really great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for agreeing to join me. We can tell everyone a little bit more about why we set this up later. But first of all, big welcome. And tell us a little bit about you and how you got into horses, maybe in general, but more specifically, how you got led down the path that I know that you're on these days.
Well, that's a hard one.
It's a long one.
I think there've always been horses, and you know, everybody says the same thing. When you're a child, you want to be gentle and be your pony's friend, don't you? I think with me there's probably a fair amount of I don't know, it's a difficult one. I'm clinically empathetic. I'm terrible with people. I absorb everything and become them. And that is useless. But with horses, it is useful. So I do generally know what they're thinking and what they're about to do. When I was small and I was being told that I had to, you know, I had to be in control of a pony, or I had to do this or I had to do that, it was terrifying. So I think a lot of where I've ended up was probably me managing that fear. I desperately wanted to be with horses, to work with horses, to spend time with them. I was also aware that the horses didn't really want to be there. And it not everybody is prepared to see that. They don't want to know that horses aren't happy about things. And I mean, we all have this experience. So, you know, so you'll go horse shopping with someone and you'll find a horse and they get the horse home and everything seems like it's going to be perfect. And the horse decides to get home and jump on the therapy couch. It unpacks everything. Well, actually, I don't like that head collar. And actually, no, I'm not standing at the mounting block. And no, that hurts. And no, you can't do that. But if you're working with horses, particularly sort of high level performance horses, and they're aware that you can hear them, it's a difficult conversation to have because you can't unpack everything. And I've always been given the horses to work with that nobody else wants to spend the time with. If it takes 3 hours to get a head collar on, nobody's going to do it. If they're afraid of you when you walk in the stable, they'll just walk back out again and the horse has to go home or someone else has to do it. And I always enjoyed doing that. And I always enjoyed doing the rehab work as well, stretching and walking and more walking and a bit more walking. So you get to spend a lot of time with horses. And that always seemed to be in conflict with the other side of what I was doing, which was breeding and producing really quite sparkly, expensive dressage horses.
How did that kind of come about? Why did you get drawn that down that route then, Polly?
I think that was decided for me. I was I worked at Alden Craig Equestrian Centre before it was world famous, when it still had decent people in charge. We probably shouldn't say that, but we're going to. And I somehow got picked up as having a degree of talent with horses. And I was earmarked to be sent abroad to learn more, that they had a working relationship with yards in Denmark and Sweden and places like that. So they were sending students there with some funding to help you keep yourself alive, I think, really. And I was lucky enough that I was picked to do that. And I think originally I'd been earmarked to go to a sort of equine therapy centre. And I was supposed to do my year out there and then come back and help set up something similar over here. And I started there, and then I got moved to the yard that the people that owned the therapy centre also owned, because they decided that they needed me to work there. I think one of my friends was there already, and he'd been given the choice of two of us, and he said they wanted to know who they wanted to come and work for them, basically. And he said, well, the other chap, you know, he's a good bloke, he's great to have around, he's a lot of fun, doesn't really work very hard, he's here for the riding and for the glory. But if you have Polly, she will be there until the job is done. And they're like, right, well, that's what we want. So that's how I ended up there. And it wasn't easy. I mean, the horses, some of them are terrifying, and they, you know, there is all of that element of, they think it's funny to put the English girl on the horse that hasn't been out of his stable for 3 weeks and everything. I got there, and the boss said, we're going to give you the horses to look after. We've heard that you're good at looking after the horses, and I've got some special horses that are, you know, they have tendon injuries or whatever. And he showed me what he wanted to do. I had to change the warm wool bandages. That was very important. They had to have warm wool bandages. You can imagine at that point, I was a bit like, this is interesting. Okay, the warm wool bandages. And I had to walk them in hand, and I had to keep an eye on their feet not rotting. Now, those simple things. I had to do their exercise programs. And I said to him, what should I feed them? And he looked at me and he said, what do you mean, what should you feed them? I said, well, if they're resting, what should I feed them? And he said, follow me. And he took me to the feed room, and all the horses eat whole oats, whole barley and maize and soya. And they get several scoopfuls a day. That's what they live on. And he said, what do you call this? What are these? And I said, those are oats. And these ones, those are barley. He said, this, you feed him oats. Oh, this is going to be fun. That was where I started.
Oh, Baptism of fire kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Wow. Yeah.
And that sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I saw some really horrible things. He was by far from the most brutal trainer. He really tried not to be. He got a German education, but the pressure's on. You have to produce the results. And I can't ride like that. My hands don't take that strain. So I've always got round horses a different way. And I had some very lovely horses to ride and did some lovely work, but it's all, the horses are not given a choice, are they?
No, they pay for it in some way. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. So yeah, I wouldn't be doing that now, but yeah, I think I have always used food with training. I just didn't realize probably I was using it properly. And when I came back to the UK and then moved up to Norfolk and started collecting clients and people to work with, I ended up with a lot of rehab cases, a lot of very anxious horses, a lot of very anxious owners who needed not to be told to shout at their horse and ride through it. And I just carried on using all sorts of subtle methods, I suppose, giving horses time, using food if they needed food, but probably not in a terribly organized way. And at the beginning of positive reinforcement being used for horses, there were a lot of trainers doing it really quite badly, and there was a lot of interesting information being misinterpreted coming out from the dog training world. And I looked at it then, and I looked at the work being produced and thought, I don't like it, I'm not doing that. And so I didn't really pay a lot of attention, and I carried on reading things. I learned a lot, you know, I started reading about learning theory, and I don't think I've ever come across any new information that shocked me. It just sort of makes sense and slots in when you read, oh, that's why it works.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I have a horse that lives with me, and he's related to all of my horses, and he will be here until he dies. He fell out with his trainer. His owner was very into intelligent horsemanship, and he was a youngster. She'd had him from birth, and he never really got it. He just doesn't think it's intelligent. And he reached a point in his training where he was so traumatized he wouldn't move. He would rear up and spend 45 minutes on his hind legs, or he would not move, and that was it. So when he came back to stay with us again, I had a conversation with his owner, and she said, well, what are we going to do? And I said, she was quite anti using food because she'd been told that he'd bite and it would be difficult. And he can bite. He bit a woman who said Julie to him once. He has a number of hot words that he has not forgotten.
So
we don't say those words. She said, what are we going to do with him? How are we going to? And I said, well, we're going to use food. We're going to click a train. This is what we're going to do here. And we did. And he can't be moved if he gets worried about things. But by and large, he lets me know, and I know how to manage him. And we got a long way. We did an awful lot. And I think horses like him, it just makes sense. I don't know that I follow the rules terribly well. I kind of follow the horse rather than the horse. So I'm a messy trainer.
I think that is the rules. I think, you know, the rules are there for the scientists, really. And then we adapt them as per each horse that we see. And I always say to students, I will tell you A today, and tomorrow I'll tell you Z. And you'll say, why did you not tell me this then? And because you can't learn it all like at once. No. And you're probably like me, and you apply something and afterwards think, oh, I'll work out the science, but what was going on there? And you can always make it fit. But there will be just that natural feeling of, this horse needs this now. And then, but there aren't always that many people who can work like that. And so I suppose the pernickety bit of me is there for them who make the mistakes and get bitten or get, we shouldn't keep talking about biting and click training because it's absolutely unfounded. Horses that bite will bite regardless of whether you click a train. But the stressful side comes out in the horse and the bits drop and everything. Really, when people stand in front of a horse and go, oh, I don't know what to do. It's never because you did the wrong thing. It's nearly always because you didn't do anything. So he sounds like he's been a really great learning curve. in life for you anyway.
Yes, the other horses, you know, he still speaks the language of the horse as per Monty Roberts, which is tricky. He's not a subtle horse to other horses.
No.
And they do struggle with him. But I mean, coming back to biting, his younger half brother, when he was born, he stood up and the sun came up and he neighed to the world and said, "I am the king." And his dad neighed from around the corner and said, "Funny, because I thought I was." And his little face, he was like,
"There's another one."
Yeah. He was just born knowing that he is meant for amazing things. And he got to 3 weeks old and you could hear him coming across, you know, across the garden with his teeth clacking, ready to bite you. He found biting really funny. Other horses, other people, the dog, the fence, squeaky toys. And he was 2.5 before I worked out that I needed to feed him to stop him biting us. Right. You know, at the time, it was really not that you don't train aggressive horses with food. Clicker training doesn't work for biters. And I'm like, well, how am I going to train him not to bite unless I... So yeah. I just brought him there. And actually, that was the quickest turnaround we've ever had. We taught him to lick instead because he had a need for oral behaviours.
Yeah.
And so he'd come across the field with his tongue sticking out and say, "Can I lick you for a biscuit?"
It's better than the teeth. I mean, and that's the thing, isn't it? If you want things to change, you have to do something about it. And food can be marvellous at that. I wanted to hop back to something that you said really early on, which was that these horses that people go and buy, they go horsey shopping and it seems fine. And honestly, if I went through my case records, I would say that 70% at least of my cases are people that don't end up with the horse they thought they bought. Mm-hmm. And it unpacks it literally, you know, sort of gets onto the couch and goes, right, now while I'm here and I don't like this and I don't like that and I won't go out on my own. And I won't go in a field with lots of other horses and I won't canter out on a and all those things. And I just want, it was really refreshing to hear you say it as well, because I think a lot of people that listen have got or have had knowledge of those horses and they think, why me? What have I done? But actually, you're doing the right thing. You're listening to the horse. And the minute that you listen, your horse will start unpacking themselves. So the only way for them not to get onto that couch is for you to carry on the way that people have done previously, which is not a very nice outcome for the horse. But yeah, not to take it personally, guys.
Absolutely. Yes, it's just what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even if you have a horse from the beginning, you still find things, don't you?
Oh, 100%, yeah.
You move home with them or something happens that upsets them and you realise that they weren't as okay with things as they said they were. But yeah, the whole new horse thing, it's impossible. I don't think you could get a horse that just comes and is okay with stuff.
No, it's not who a horse is generally.
No.
And we like to forget that, and all the competition people like to, you know, sort of find ways around it, which is why it's quite hard to work with competition people in terms of behaviour, because there are limits to how far you can move. You might be able to get a bit of turnout, or you might be able to get somebody to carefully put a saddle on following a certain protocol, but there are limits. The horse is still going to be ridden and it's still going to have to, So it's quite hard for people. So let's get into a little bit about why I wanted to have why I didn't just want it to be me talking about this topic. And this is a call out for people who aren't on the UK Clicker Training FY group. Yeah. Get on there. Because it is just for UK people, and we only, I think we're short of 1,000, even 800 and odd members, and I can't believe that's the only number of people at Clicker Train in the UK. So, you know, it's well worth joining just to sort of chat in a friendly environment. But somebody was asking about rope halters, and it was actually a kind of half head collar, half rope halter, and I mean, that wasn't anything I had a problem with, but it did bring up the conversation about whether rope halters are aversive and whether we can actually train a horse to do things that doesn't require pulling on anything, regardless of whether it's a rope or it's a head collar.
Yeah.
And right at the beginning, I should, I suppose, say that I'm so old that when I had my first pony, all we had was halters. Not rope holders. Well, they were made of rope, but they were
the white ones. Yeah.
Yeah, the flat webbing noseband and the rope that went around the ear. And if your pony ran off and you were on the other end of it, he basically couldn't breathe.
Fell off.
it tightened. Oh yeah, but no, because the ones when I did it, we knotted it so it couldn't tighten, but they literally would pull around the pole.
Oh yeah, and tighten right just, up. Yes.
Yeah, and they didn't have any way of letting go. So yeah, I maybe didn't come from the best background in terms of halters, so I have a bit of a ooh about those. And also maybe to say that in Canada and the US, for sure, that halters mean head collars often. So what we call a head collar is nice flat pieces of preferably something that breaks relatively easy. And you can buy them now that are specifically field safe and will break. But we're talking about the rope halters that probably have been around for forever since somebody got on the horse thousands and thousands of years ago, I imagine. But now they came back in sort of, I suppose, in the early 2000s, late 90s. I'm not sure when natural horsemanship happened because it didn't happen to me. So I kind of had I went straight from, you know, traditional to clicker training. So it wasn't kind of a, but I believe that that's where they came from, because everybody that I turn up to that is a natural horsemanship person will have one. And I think that's kind of the Pirelli time and that when it came out. And these are quite fine cord, I would say. I wouldn't even call them rope head collars. They're quite a thin cord, aren't they? And
they're yacht braid.
Yeah, they don't break. So your horse is going to do themselves a lot of damage if they get tied up and they can't move away from it, aren't they? Yeah, so this is what we started then to have a conversation about. Some of the people on the forum did, and talking about whether, you know, how aversive, and should you use it if it is aversive, and if you're not sure if it hurts more than your head collar, it's dead easy to trial it. You know, I often get clients to have a feel of it. You don't have to have it around your neck or anything terrible, just around your elbow, you know, the crease of your elbow or something, and pull on it and feel the difference. But I would say that none of them give that kind of pinprick sharp cue that if we were thinking of it being very, so none of them are great for, I don't think, for particularly delivering cues. So they're said by the natural horsemanship world, I think, to be like a training tool or a training aid that you teach your horse with. And you might be able to clear this up, because I know you have many deep thoughts and things that you've read and stuff. But, you know, everyone always says the knots on it are in certain places. But I have heard people say that's absolute rubbish. You just have to have the knot there to make the head collar the shape it is. But, you know, they do have knots on as well, don't they?
They do have knots. And the knots, I think if they're fitted properly and you make them to measure, I did used to make them. I went through a phase of making quite a lot of them because they're quite fun to do. I like things with string and knots. Yeah, you do have to knot them together. I think it was Quantum Savvy. They had, may have come from the Pirelli world as well. There was a process where you moved up the levels, and once your horse is trained with the knotted head collar, sometimes you do start with the one with extra knots across the nose and across the pole if you have a horse that doesn't want to listen to you. So that tells you why the knots are there. But once your horse is trained to be light to the aid, you then have a spliced one. And there are no knots on a spliced head collar other than the big one under the chin. So in theory, you're supposed to work towards needing less painful pressure. You can make them without using the knots. You can bind the corners. You can do a lot of things, but it doesn't really detract from the fact that they are still made of yacht braid. I think a lot of people now use the mule tape ones, don't they, which are flatter and you plait them together. They're a much lighter one. People, you know, a lot of my horses, we have six here. And I think Indy obviously doesn't like head collars at all. Everything on his head is a bad idea. Of the five remaining, four of them would probably choose to have the rope halter on if I gave them the choice. They don't like clangy things. They don't like heavy things. Because they're light, because they, you know, they don't tend to get in their way. The one that would not choose one is the one that came off worse when my ex-partner hauled her over something with a rope halter when she was little and her face swelled up. You know, that was one event, and he used his weight on the rope when I asked him just to stand with her while I went to get the treat, and he pulled her over. And she would not choose one now because she knows what they do. Horses are not silly. It doesn't take more than one belt off a rope halter and they're not going to argue again.
No, I agree. And I think for me, when we lived in France, I use them all the time because they go through the washing machine, not the knotted ones, just the, you know, the bog standard. They were about €5 in the horsey shop, and they were brilliant, just so easy. And I have clients that still use them for that reason. Mm. And so we're not saying they are intrinsically evil, as in most tools aren't intrinsically. There are some that are, clearly, but mostly in terms of rope halters, most people will be using them to lead, and their horse can already lead, because you're talking about horses that can already lead. You're not talking about, I'm going out, giving them a yank on the halter
here he
and
comes,
telling
them
how to do it. Yeah, we're not talking that at all. And I think this is where there's a little bit of loss of clarity for people, because they know that in the traditional world, horses are taught by pressure and release. So they think you have to use pressure on them. And even though they swap to the positive world, they maybe don't see that people are using, it's nothing. It's just like a piece of, you know, sort of cotton between you and your horse. It's not meant to give cues. Well, mine isn't. I mean, I don't intend to get any cue off a rope, not intentionally. There might be a feel down the rope that might cause some sort of movement on the horse's
sensation,
head.
Yeah,
but it's not kind of like pressure that you're going to go, oh, here you go, I better respond to this. And I suppose that's where negative and positive really show up their differences, is that we don't take our cue from the way that we develop the behavior in the first place. So we instantly lose that pressure regardless when we're teaching with food. And so I think there might be that element of people that crossed over from natural horsemanship. It's almost like they want to throw everything away and say, you know, it sounds like I'm trying to say use a rope halter. I'm absolutely not. I would never advise a client to use one now. But I just, you know, digging down into why people can feel really enraged about them, I do wonder if it is that the people that crossed over feel, you know, sort of they still have that hangover of teaching pressure with it, which is not nice.
I think, I mean, it's like anything. If you have a piece of equipment, you probably will use it. My favourite lead ropes to use are hollow core rope, because it, I mean, it's designed to float on water, I think, but it, you can't, you cannot swing a rope and clout a horse with it. Exactly. And if you're teaching people who, you know, we all forget when we're learning, you forget that we're not doing that anymore. It's much easier to give someone something that it's also lighter for the horse. They don't have the pressure, you know, the rope dragging down on their nose, but you have to take away all of those things that you might be able to use in that way. And suddenly you realize what you've got.
Yeah.
I can't remember quite where I was going with that, but but with rope halters, it's a bit like bits and young horses or backing youngsters. Yes, you might only ride your horse once a week for 5 minutes, but if something goes wrong, you're going to have to ride through that problem. You've done too much, haven't you? If you've got the rope halter on and something happens, you have used it. And I think people are afraid of taking their horses out and their horses getting away. That's the big fear, isn't it?
Massive. And I agree. And I, you and me both feel sort of very safety conscious when we're thinking about what, because I know we've talked about this for the Facebook group and what we should sort of try and make sure people listen to and don't post things that are very not safety conscious. But, you know, that there are things that you have to do sometimes. There are people who have fields that are separated by a lane or a road, and they might have to cross it at some point. So there are times when we have to. I think the thing for me with a rope halter opposed to something like a bit in a mouth, or even worse, something like a chifney or something, is that even though the rope halter will hurt, it won't kick in with the sort of accuracy and painfulness that a bit will. And so I think people think they do a lot worse. I think they have the long-term effects that you're talking about, like with your mare, who now is like, you know, I hate those things, I'm not good. But they're, even though they're that cord, they are still not a sharp device compared to a piece of metal. I mean, it's just not likely. So, you know, I don't like any of those things. You can train around them, but if you go on the road thinking you're safe with a rope halter, I think you're kidding yourself, because if you're not safe on the road, you're not safe
you're
on
not
the
safe.
Road with a rope
Absolutely.
Halter.
But yeah, it's that. I mean, I did have a young horse who got away not so long ago, and I mean, totally unexpected situation. She's very good and very brave. And two gentlemen and a dog were out jogging, and they were coming off a footpath across the road towards us. And I think we were all taken aback. They carried on going, and one chap then went up the bank with his dog. So the poor horse had nowhere to go, and they didn't stop. And we were, stop, stop. And they, oh, maybe we better go the other way. I'm like, yeah. But she did. She turned, and because the road was so narrow, there was no way of getting her back. She had a flathead collar on, and she trod on the rope and broke it. She actually waited for us. She didn't want to go home by herself. So huge amount of fear for us, but it was all okay. However, that just that jerk on her nose, she was quite unhappy about it. It hurt her nose and she didn't like it. If she'd had a rope halter on, she probably would have done more damage, and she'd still have got away. She was going, whatever happened.
It just hurts more, but they'll pull through it. Because there is that thing, that moment when a horse thinks, I'm dead. If I don't go, I'm dead.
I'm dead,
There's no sort of displacement behaviour before it. There's nothing to tell you what's happening. It's just like, I'm getting out of here. And when there's that much pressure and there's us on the end of a rope, there's nothing. I was thinking about this, actually. It's a total down a rabbit hole. When you were talking about the trainers out in Denmark, and I had a Swedish dressage trainer for a long time, and she said that her male trainers always said, you're just not strong enough, you girls. You've got to, and they were trying to get her to hold a chair up by one leg, like a dining chair. And she said, I couldn't even get it off the floor, and these blokes are just able to pick it up. And she said, that's why I can't ride like you ride. And I don't want to ride like you ride. But we can't hold on to a horse. If a horse is going, they're going to go. Rope halter, possibly even bit and chipney are only going to buy you tiny amounts of time if they decide they're absolutely going.
Yeah.
It's hopeless.
And you're just adding more injuries to an already bad situation. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, so you might as well be out in a nice flat head collar, but if they put their foot on the rope, it will just snap somewhere. You have to buy yourself a new one, but no big deal about it.
Yeah.
And that was where the sort of conversation started, and I think we've probably done enough about rope halters. I don't want to give them any more airtime. You can want to bring your horse up the field, and you can let go of it when they run away or whatever. I'm sure it's not a problem at all. And some of my clients still use them and are happy to use them, but we don't use them as training tools. Yeah. They're just easy.
We don't let our horses loose in them either. Please don't show me your horse loose.
Nor tie them up, nor tie them up to a trailer or
trailer or in a trailer.
None of those. Yeah. We don't like any of those. But then the conversation was like, well, I've taught my horse to pick their head up from grass, or, maybe I can stop them from going somewhere because I've got such good cues that I can. So I think we've already said that in itself is probably not easy to do when they're running away. But can we talk through the idea of a protocol where you can let your horse graze and then you say, right, up you get, we're going to carry on. Because I think we probably have had experience of this protocol, both very similar.
Yes.
Let's talk through what would be roughly, really roughly, because I tend not to want to get down too deep into the nitty-gritty. People can come to you or me to get personal information. but roughly, how are we looking at teaching something like a head-up protocol in a poly world?
Oh, it depends on the horse. I mean, some of them you can teach them in a yard, and you could have a nice bucket of chaff and teach them to do it with a target, or just off a very light pressure, or off a pre-existing cue, and they just accept it, and that's fine, and you can then transfer it to the grass. I would always, it's a little bit about timing, isn't it? For the horses that do take a breath in between eating mouthfuls, you might find that place where they'll listen. Some of them don't. And some of them, they're always happy. You give them a warning, a 1, 2, 3, 4 up, and it gives them a warning that we're going to stop in a minute. Some of them don't learn it very well.
And I think this is what we need to blow apart a bit, because there's a lot said on social media quite randomly often. Just teach him head up. I taught my horse head up.
Yeah, good
luck. I think there are then poor people that go out and try this and then cry forever because they think they're the only person that couldn't teach their horse to pick their head up.
well, we have a lot of horses, don't we, that, you know, they have metabolic disorders. They will be leptin resistant. They don't have an off switch. Horses that have to live on reduced amounts of grazing and then suddenly you take them out in the world and it's full of grass. It's all very well to say always start your session with your horse full of food, always have other food for it to eat, but there isn't much to many horses that is more reinforcing than filling their face with grass, especially if nobody's eaten the grass before and you found it at the side of the road. It can be very difficult to transfer that from a training situation to an out in the world situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And I'm going to come to a story that is actually dog related, which always tickled me. And I've seen it a lot. And I might meet dog trainers when I'm walking my dogs. And I met this lady and she had two sight hands. I don't quite know what they were, but they were very bouncy. And as they bounced over to me, she pressed her clicker and they ran back to her. And she gave them some food. Totally. I mean, talk about timing. You know, it's just not timing at all. But actually, it's a fantastic protocol. If you've never used a mechanical clicker with your horse, just teach your horse that when you click that button, you will give it something absolutely amazing. And then for the odd, I wouldn't say that's just for everyday grass, head up out of grass, but that moment, and that's what she was doing, that lady with her dogs, she didn't care whether she was training them to run up to me and then come back to her. She didn't care less about that. That was fine. What she wanted them to do was hear the click and know that she was going to get her goodie bag out and go, here you go. And I think it's we get a bit snotty about clicker training, some of us, you know, and I try not to be, and I love the nitty gritty, but I also love real world solutions for people who don't want that, you know? And so having, it might not be a clicker. I'm sure you can think of something in your house that has a novel sound.
Noise,
sound like anything else that you can use, whether it's a whistle that you can put, and you only use it for that. It's like dog whistles for come home. You know, I only use it for comeback, and it always has a treat on it. It never won't have some food on it. So, you know, in sort of emergency situations when you think your horse might run soon or it might be going to get its head down to grass if you don't break that moment. I suppose there are, you know, there is a lot to be said for treating, you know, that's just a nice classical conditioning situation where you hear this, you're going to get that, regardless of what you're doing. You could be pulling on the end of the lead rope, trying to get to the grass, bang, here we go, and they go, oh. But even that isn't perfect. But that is a potentially a really easy one for people who aren't invested in clicker training or following any rules at all. But I love your idea. So you start in the yard, nice and easy. There's no distractions. There's no grass there for them to kind of, But then it's difficult, isn't it? Because we've got to morph that out to grass.
Grass. I mean, there are some horses where actually I think it is probably better for them, better for the owner, better health-wise, to pre-train having the munch and done muzzles and filling them with food, make those a positive thing. So the food is just not available. And it doesn't take them long to put their head down and go, oh. And you can put the treat in it so they're still
rewarded.
Anyway.
I mean,
it's an easier situation to have.
I agree.
And there are some horses that works very well. There are some horses that doesn't work very well for. You have to find something else. And some horses, you just have to face it. You might be grazing your way around until they decide they want to walk.
Absolutely. But not to feel that it's because you're a bad trainer or that your skills aren't enough. You know, sometimes I get asked to help people and I think, you've done everything. I'm looking for tiny, tiny, weeny changes. And sometimes it might just be go a bit slower because, you know, if you do two lots of buckets on the yard on two sessions and then go out to grass, it's not enough. You need changes in the brain to start taking place. Those cues, I don't know many people that have really good cues, which is why I do think a mechanical cue can be so helpful. You can't get it wrong, really, if it's a mechanical one. I think doing it enough in that safe space where there isn't anything and then maybe building up to temptation in that safe place. But, yeah, just going out. And then as soon as you let your horse down to graze, You're like, oh, I want them to have something nice. As it's pre-mac and all that, you know. Pre-mac can do one right now, because really I just need to exercise my EMS horse.
This horse, yeah.
And the best way to do it is trotting around the lanes around here while I run. And that's not going to happen if we keep stopping for snacks.
Grass, no, it's not. We have gained more calories on this trip than we have expended. That happens a lot. It is a tricky one, and I think there are some horses that just get it, and they're never, you know, they're not inclined to use a lot of force. You can always use your ideal pressure in every situation, and there are some horses you could probably drive a tractor up and lift them in the bucket and they'd still be eating, because the food is what they want, and they're not bothered by anything we do to them.
Absolutely. But I think it's catching it often before that moment. I can't remember. I think it's Stan at Hazel who literally can set his neck, and he's a strong he's gone. And it was quite hilarious because we had Gabriel there from Brazil, and he's trying desperately hard to be very positive reinforcement. He's a vet, you know, and he's trying to break the mold of men and, you know, forceful training, bless him, and he's doing a great job. And I talked him through how it would look, you know, he will get partway down this little dirt track, and there's enough grass that Stan's going to go, I want to get to that. And even with that, and even as a quite a strong bloke, he just went and couldn't stop it.
Yep.
The next day, we had a lovely female trainer with us, and I won't say which natural horsemanship group she comes from, but she was trying to find out about positive reinforcement. Mm-hmm. Kudos to her for doing that. And I tell you, because her observational skills were on it, we didn't even tell her about Stan. That wasn't out of unfairness. It just hadn't got to that point. She was leading him back to the field. And I tell you, he went to go, and she just turned around and faced into him. And he was so shocked that somebody had spotted him that he just went, oh, okay. And there was a little bit of rope pressure, but there wasn't a ton. It was very carefully and quietly done. And he walked all the way to the field and didn't try it again. Now, which of those situation is the most positive in the moment? I know which one I feel happiest with, and whilst it might not be what all of us lovely positive people sort of want to be the ideal, it's not ideal, it's not perfect, but you know, it solved the problem with a lot less hassle and a lot less problems for Stan or his handler. So I think it's we're doing a bad job of selling this, really, I think, Polly, aren't we?
We are, aren't we? Yeah. No, I mean, the horse I was out with this morning, we have some underlying issues that we're trying to find the source of. There is pain there. She's a youngster that's had probably not the best upbringing, not the best handling, very traditional. And she's very self-assured. She knows her own mind. She knows what she can do and what she can't do. And what she wants as well. She's absolutely not averse to moving me out of her way to get what she wants. And she's two, and we have a chance at this point to retrain that behavior. We can't work just with food, because she's still a little bit antsy. There's a potential that she might have some gut stuff going on. She's definitely got physical stuff going on, so she's not really in a place where we can just do lots of training sessions on light cues and stand and walk and back up. And she gets very upset with that quite quickly, and she starts having to eat you for the food, and we don't need to do that. We use food, we use it gently, so we're out walking with her because that's what she likes to do, and she also likes to graze quite a lot. And if we stop to graze, she will mostly walk on again when it's time to go. And then she thinks she'd like some more. So her little face will change, and she'll start trying to round you up and push you off the edge into the grass. And with her, it's the same. It's about timing. If I can keep my hand close to her, and I can keep her head up without using any pressure, and I can keep myself in front of her, we can keep going. We can stand. We can be rewarded for standing, and we can move on again. It takes a bit of practice. Sometimes she does manage to run in front of me. But you can improve that without using too much pressure. And ultimately, it's a lot less than she was having used before she came to where she is now. And we're not having to pull her head up out of the grass or retrieve her from the middle of a crop field. all of these things are positives, I feel.
These are wins, definitely.
These
Polly,
are wins. And she loves going out and she doesn't want to go home. So quite often we have to go further. You know, it's not, we are not forcing her to go out for walks. That's what she wants to do. She'll stand at the gate going, when are we going out? What will we do? Where are we going?
Awesome.
So it's highly individualistic, isn't it? And I think trying to
very
do
much everything, so, But I think that the very first rule of all behaviour is don't let it happen. It all behaviour you don't want.
Stop it before it happens.
And once
don't
it happens, let go with whatever the situation and your ego is and just move on from that. Think, how can I change this next time? Patterns. Horses love patterns. So any sort of pattern you can start to build, whether it's, you know, one of Leslie McDevitt's sort of counting type patterns, which are designed to be dead simple for people to use, or if it's like we're saying, practice it on the yard and then go out onto grass with it when you're really confirmed and your horse is really on to you. And to accept that some horses are just going to be harder, and to know that you need to investigate, as you're saying with that mare, that, you know, there might be pain issues and that, you know, there are other things at play, and never just assume that it's just your horse's love for grass that is sending them wild and not have them listen to you. There's a lot.
There is a lot, and you know, it's all, it all comes back to what you find when you get there. There isn't, like you said before, there isn't a solution that's going to work every day, and some days it's as well to say, let's not go out today. That's a really important one, isn't it? Don't let it happen. Today is not that day.
And also, don't look at that day as your only data for like the last month, because you might have had 10 lovely trips out, nothing gone wrong. One day out of 10 is not a bad, you know, set of numbers for me anyway. I'd be very happy.
It's pretty good.
If you're looking at 10 days, it's awful, and one day she did well, then you think, okay, we'll have to have a few more good days before I'm prepared to change my opinion of what's going on here. So, take it all as part of the bigger picture rather than getting too upset that, oh, you had a bad day when you've had quite a few good days. And yes, nobody's lying to you that this isn't a protocol. It very much is a protocol, teaching heads up. And, you know, I remember doing a demo at Hazel's, and Hazel did it for me. And she said, what do you want me to do? And we talked through it. She did it. And it was like magic. It just happened so perfectly that you think, gosh, that now everyone's going to think that it's that.
That's how it goes. Yeah.
It isn't. That was just luck. And I hate doing demos for that reason, because they often don't work how you would want them to work, how the perfect science works. But it does work. I mean, people that are telling you on the internet that it works, we're being a bit mean and insane that it can't work. Of course it can work, it takes quite a lot of effort from the trainer, and a lot of people don't have that time and didn't sign up for that sort of training when they got their horse, did they?
No. And, you know, different types of horses, all of mine know their name. So like you were saying with your mechanical cue, it's really easy, and they're very light. They've never, you know, they're very little horses. They'd be very easy to pull if you needed to, but we don't need to. It just is, you know, sometimes people pick a horse that perhaps they're never going to be able to train the way they might want to. And it is being able to accept those limitations, I think, and being able to help people understand that it does work, it will work. And also, if we're bringing behavior into it, sometimes it's inappropriate to be doing that. This isn't the right horse for that job.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, unless you've got anything burning that we, should have said that we haven't said, can we look at where people who live in Norfolk and would love to get in touch with you to help them with their horse who keeps wanting to get to grass? And I know you're always super busy, or I know you're a trimmer as well. Where can people find Polly?
I don't advertise anywhere.
I know you don't. I know.
Probably Facebook. They might have to come onto the UK Clicker Trainers page and start a conversation.
There you go.
Yeah, I think that probably is. Most of my work comes through word of mouth, and that's that sort of works. But
I'm sure if you need to find Polly, you'll find her. I put all your details sort of that we can find, where we can find you ish on the show notes for this one. It's been really, really lovely to chat, and it's always lovely to have somebody else's ideas, and it kind of pushes me to investigate mine a little bit deeper as well. So thanks for that, Polly. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. As always, I hope you can share the podcast in as many places as possible. This information only gets out there through you making that effort. Thank you so much to those of you who always do. And if you can give me a 5-star review anywhere that you listen to this, that is possible, that really helps get the podcast pushed in front of more people. Thank you for listening, and hope you're along for the next one very soon.